This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area. Joining us first, WCPO.com issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn and Cincinnati Inquirer heroin and social issues reporter Terry Demio as we discuss the latest on the opioid crisis, including the Ohio Attorney General filing suit against several prescription drug manufacturers. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Terry and Lisa, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lisa, start us off by telling us about this lawsuit that Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine filed. Who's he suing and what's this all about?
Yeah, so our Attorney General here in Ohio is taking on the five largest drug makers of opioids in the U.S. So that's Purdue Pharma, Endo Health Solutions, Teva Pharmaceutical Industry, and then there are some subsidiaries of those drug makers that are also a part of the suit. And the whole complaint here alleges that these pharmaceutical firms took on deceptive marketing practices as they sold and distributed opioids. And because of that, we are in the state that we are in with a heroin and opioid epidemic. So he's blaming these marketing practices of these alleged marketing practices of these firms on the crisis that, you know, the public health crisis that state officials say we face.
So what are some of the deceptive practices that he's claiming? I guess an example would be he's claiming that they say the drugs are not addictive if used properly. Is that one of the things?
That's right, that they really played down how addictive that these drugs were. One big concern that is called out in here is that there was a lot of prescribing of opioids for long-term chronic pain, and that science over time has shown and proven that these opioids are not effective in treating long-term chronic pain, and using these opioids long-term puts you at an incredibly high risk of addiction. And that's primarily one of the big arguments made in here.
Terry, what are your thoughts on this lawsuit? Is this going to be an effective way of dealing with at least part of the opioid crisis that we face?
Yeah, I think it will. The National Institute of Drug Abuse has shown us through surveys that about 80% of people these were self-reported kind of surveys, you know, 80% of people who have heroin use disorder, heroin addiction, say that they started with prescription pain medications, which are opioids. And, you know, many of them used them as directed. Some did not. Some people got them from many got them from, you know, a cabinet or from somebody at home and began to use them. But clearly, this was the big, the start of the big resurgence of heroin in our communities. And then we've been led to, as you all know, fentanyl, which is an opioid in itself.
Now, Lisa, the lawsuit doesn't it compare Big Pharma with Big Tobacco at some point?
Yeah.
And then the filing?
It does. So DeWine specifically made that link to, you know, Big Pharma and the practices that he describes here as being like those practices of Big Tobacco that downplayed all the risks of smoking for decades and decades. And the lawsuit, he says, he compares the drug makers to Big Tobacco, alleging, and this is his words in the lawsuit, that like the tobacco companies, defendants used third parties that they funded, directed, and controlled to carry out and conceal their scheme to deceive doctors and patients about the risks and benefits of long-term opioid use for chronic pain. So again, they're pointing to deceptive practices that downplayed big risks and then went on to incredible severe health costs for the community.
So that's the parallel. Anybody out there saying that might be a stretch?
There is. You know, there was an attorney. Some will say that you know, there is a role for prescription opioids in the community and in health, in medicine, and that when you think about cigarettes and smoking, that that is an elective, you know, that's that it's a different kind of consumer behavior. Somebody's choosing to put that into their body rather than having been prescribed something from a physician. So there are some differences there that would lead some to believe that it's a bit of a stretch in making the comparison. But I think DeWine's point is when you're just looking at these marketing practices, he sees some similarities.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And Terry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that a lot of the parents of people with heroin opioid addiction were, in our area, were really cheering this lawsuit when it was filed. There's social media, you know, promoting it, saying it's about time. And, you know, you can understand their from their perspective why. But it is getting a lot of attention here in our communities.
Terry, what's going on with drug overdoses at this point? Have they leveled off, or are health officials starting to see them on the rise again?
Well, they're starting to see bursts of, you know, of more overdoses than usual. Carfentanil has been reintroduced into our communities, Dr. Smarka said a few weeks ago. We do have days that you know, there are maybe a half dozen or so overdoses in Cincinnati because they track every day, and it's a very public way of doing it. But then we get intermittent bursts. And I know that after one of the recent media stories about another surge, one doctor who has a lot of addiction patients called me and said, "This is just continuing. I don't even see it as surges now." You know, he said, regardless of whether his patients are people who are addicted or his patients are just people in the Northern Kentucky community, so every day I hear about, you know, my aunt died, my sister died, my cousin, brother, whoever. It's just maddening to people who are close to the situation. And of course, you know, devastating to families. So we are seeing it more frequently, and we're seeing these bursts more frequently.
Do they have any idea what's leading to this?
No, I mean, we're a healthy market. That's a terrible word to use, but we are a good, solid market for fentanyl, just as we were for heroin and just as we previously were for these prescription painkillers. Nobody seems to have, you know, a specific reason that they can identify for this occurring. One of the scarier things that we're hearing about is fentanyl now found in cocaine, and people overdosing from that because the cocaine user, although heroin users often use cocaine, there are plenty of cocaine users who would never touch heroin. So they are at, you know, even higher risk of overdose death, let alone overdose. And that's been happening. In fact, today I got a report from the New York City Health Department, and they said that in the city there, they just tallied that 37% of their overdoses in 2016 were cocaine fentanyl overdoses, and that was up from 11% in 2015. So, you know, it's occurring more and more now.
Yeah, you're definitely seeing, you know, as this epidemic evolves, the introduction of these synthetic opioids is really scaling up. And to the point that Terry was just making, we're seeing it in drugs like cocaine and even marijuana. As Terry just mentioned, there are users of marijuana and cocaine out there that would never think of touching heroin or some other stronger synthetic opioid, and yet it's going into their system. The theory is often unbeknownst to them.
So why is this being introduced into other street drugs? Lisa, are there any ideas as to why the dealers are doing this?
Well, there are some theories out there that law enforcement have shared with me and former, recovering addicts have shared with me that once you introduce these stronger drugs into a cocaine or a marijuana, they become more addictive and the user wants more of that drug. Terry might have something to add there, but it's a scary notion. Yeah, go ahead, Terry.
No, absolutely, Lisa. You're right on that. I've heard from police sources that, maybe they're trying to hook cocaine users to an opioid. While the Cuyahoga County medical examiner is very upfront saying that in his community, what he's seeing is a whole new demographic of deaths from opioids because they were cocaine users. And he's saying that the African-American population of opioid-related deaths, he thinks will double from last year based on where he is now. And he said in his community, cocaine is often used in that community. Now, the DEA folks will say they're not trying to specifically target, a certain population, a certain demographic. They're just pouring it out there. And maybe some street-level dealers would want to, target specific people. But, I think it's kind of a little bit of guesswork at this point. Do you think so, Lisa?
I think so. What's hard to know at this point is there a demand for it? So are the users asking for this, or is this just what they're getting? And to your point, it's a bit of guesswork now, and unfortunately, I think time will tell sort of what is driving these combinations that we're finding. But literally, when you look at autopsy reports of these individuals who have overdosed, it looks like they have been on a multi-day binge of opioids, powerful, powerful opioids, marijuana, cocaine, either or. They're showing up side by side.
So there were even cases of this being introduced into the marijuana?
I've seen autopsy reports that show that, yes.
Yeah. How potent, how dangerous is fentanyl, Terry?
It's a few grains. If you shake out of a salt shaker, a few grains of salt, can potentially cause overdose or overdose death in some people. Obviously, if you have more of a tolerance to heroin or other opioids, you're going to be marginally safer. It's going to take a little more. But, yeah, it's highly deadly. We can see, how law enforcement, all of our first responders are trying to cope with it themselves. And, self-protection is extremely important. They used to field test drugs on the scene, but now they're not doing that. So it's really strong.
Well, how effective is Narcan against this?
So it's
very effective if it's done multiple times. What do you think, Lisa?
Yeah, no, go ahead, Terry.
A couple of years ago when some of the Kentucky police forces started carrying it, you would see them using, or even a year ago with Hamilton County, you would see them use, the 2 milligram dose and be able to get someone breathing again. And now a lot of them who carry that, the spray into the nostrils kind of Narcan are carrying a a very concentrated 4-milligram dose and have to use well more than that in order to revive people. But as always, the amount of time that somebody is without it is a huge determination as to whether they're going to survive.
Yeah, and the big scary thing is, depending on how powerful the opioid is, these really powerful opioids have, you know, something called a half-life. And so you can be revived, you know, after 3 or 4 doses of Narcan, and then you're revived, but the drug is still in your system and it hits you again hours, sometime later, and you have to be revived again. And just incredibly scary stories about sort of what it takes to keep someone alive.
And wasn't there a case of an officer who was exposed to fentanyl and needed Narcan?
Yeah. I think Terry just referenced that case. You know, these accidental overdoses that are occurring to law enforcement, already you can imagine they have incredibly stressful jobs, and the fact that they might happen upon these substances that are incredibly lethal. As Terry mentioned, so they're carrying multiple doses of Narcan and are being trained on, you know, what to watch out for.
Now we've had, I think...
And there's some... Oh, go on.
No, you go right ahead, Terry.
I was going to say that there are some smaller departments, police chiefs, who say, you know, we carry it for our own personnel. It's not just to rescue someone else, but in case, you know, a first responder goes down, they want to have enough to... They want to have it with them for their partners and others at the scene.
Now, 5 states have actually declared emergencies because of the situation, the heroin situation that they're facing. Ohio has not at this point. Is that correct?
That's right. Our WCPO editorial board has called on Ohio's governor to do that multiple times. And the response that we have been given is just declaring an emergency won't do much for Ohio. It won't necessarily... release more funds, even though we have an exorbitant rainy day fund built up at the state level at this point.
It's like, what, $2 billion, I believe?
Yeah, I think a little in excess of that. And that what resources Ohio can put toward this epidemic are being applied. So far, that's the response that we've been given. Other states, that doesn't seem to be the case. They're seeing more resources put into place once this emergency status is, you know, labeled and issued.
Okay, so that's what declaring an emergency does. It activates resources
that can
be used.
Yes. And puts in together a strategic, you know, a more strategic effort and plan across the state.
We had an email that they wanted to know if you could go into more detail about how a first responder can be exposed to fentanyl just through touch.
Well, fentanyl and its analogs, you'll hear all kinds of numbers. It's 30 to 50 times as potent as heroin. You'll hear others because these things aren't manufactured in, you know, quality control places. It can be a little less, it can be a lot more. And if you're unaware, fentanyl as prescribed, which is not generally what people are getting here, they're getting kind of rogue fentanyl from dealers. You can transfer that into your body through a patch. And so it can go through the skin, although most of the medical people I've talked to say, you know, it can be a cut. You can be exposed that way. So just a sprinkle of it on you can get into your system. There are a couple of DEA undercover officers. About a year ago, I think I wrote a story that they're closing a bag that had some fentanyl in it, and the slightest poof went up one of the officer's nostrils, and he inhaled it and almost immediately got very sick and you know, got all of the symptoms of the overdosing. He did not... go down. He didn't get to a point of full-on overdose. But so, yeah, it can go through cups. It can, it's just a tiny amount. You can breathe it in. So you'd be exposed to it really easily. Of course, they're doing their job being around it to either get it or to help someone who is overdosed or both. And so they're at risk.
So, Terry, is anybody seeing any light at the end of the tunnel? This just sounds like something that's going to plague us for a long, long time.
It appears it will. I mean, we are making progress. Medication-assisted treatment is more common. We're now seeing more programs, at least with one of the medications for opioid use disorder, which is injectable naltrexone that you might know as Vivitrol, you know, being used for those in jail programs or as they're released into the community. But really,
and those are used to what? Suppress your urge to take heroin, to use heroin?
It actually blocks the effects of heroin and any opioid. So it would not be effective if you took it. Although there's not much research on this, but there are people who have taken it, have used this medication for a while, who say definitively that it helps stop cravings as well. But it's non-narcotic. It's not another opiate like some of the other two FDA-approved medications. So it doesn't. It's not really designed to prevent cravings. It just seems to be working that way for a lot of people.
Lisa, what you're finding?
We're still talking about. Yeah, go on.
I just wanted to get Lisa's final thoughts as we wrap up this segment. So.
Yeah, I mean, lots of things happening on the treatment front that have been evolving. The real scare, though, is that more of these synthetic opioids are going to be flooded in the market. And the word we used earlier, it's a guessing game. There's a concern that we don't know what the next bad thing is that's going to hit.
Terry and Lisa, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
WCPO.com issues reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn and Cincinnati Inquirer heroin and social issues reporter Terry DeMio. Coming up, we'll discuss the news from Northern Kentucky and what's happening around the Commonwealth. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me now with a look at the news from Northern Kentucky, River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks, and Cincinnati and Kentucky Inquirer, River City's reporter Scott Wortman. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Michael and Scott, good to see you this afternoon.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Good to see you, too. We got some changes in leadership coming up at the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, yes. We sure do. Looks like Trey Grayson is stepping down, and Brent Cooper is coming back to fill in. He was previously an interim president at the Northern Kentucky Chamber when Steve Stevenson left several years back. But Trey Grayson surprised everyone and announced that he was stepping down this week.
And he's kind of being coy on the reason, just saying,
he was Secretary of State. Has he got any thoughts of going back into politics that anybody knows of?
The speculation is not so much political, but he's always had his eye, always wanted to be university president. And that's why he came to the chamber after he narrowly missed out on the Transylvania University gig. So coincidentally, NKU has a opening for president right now.
Yeah, there's an opening.
And Trey just says, it's just a coincidence, but they haven't started accepting applications yet, so there's still plenty of time for him to apply.
But we're just speculating at this point.
That's right.
He has not said why he's doing this, other than, I guess, maybe some family reasons. He wants more time with his family.
Well, that was the official reason cited in the news release, that he had talked to the chamber about wanting to spend some more time with his family. And remember that he did resign as Secretary of State in his second term to become the director of the Institute of Politics at Harvard University. And so he does have some experience with higher education at the most prestigious institution of higher education in America. And what you notice about Trey that may be different than other Chamber of Commerce leaders is he is very academic, and he always seems to be better in his element when he's explaining something or when he's teaching you about something. Anytime that I'd have him on a podcast or see him at an event where he was speaking, he's very analytical.
And we've had him on the show, and I'd say the same
exactly
thing. He's very good at explaining things.
And he's got good anecdotes and backstories, and he's a very good lecturer in a lot of ways. And so a university presidential gig for him would probably be appropriate.
He's also a big Star Wars fan. He gave a lecture on how Star Wars changed changed his life. So.
Yeah, he's kind of a nerd.
Yeah.
He's a nerd. He's smart.
And you mean that in the best way
possible.
Of course,
yeah. I think he would take that as a compliment, for sure. And he's also a big sports guy. So, you know, you have NKU's sports program on the rise and catching all kinds of attention. And there's another argument that he could make on his behalf that he's very familiar
with.
And
the thing that, because I've heard almost mostly, I mean, any chamber president's going to get some criticism, but I've heard mostly positive things about him. But the thing that he has going for him that most people like about him, they liked about his leadership, is he's very well connected with the politicos across the state and even across the country with his experience at Harvard. And
he was elected statewide as a Republican twice, and it used to be, I mean, as recently as his two elections, that wasn't very easy. So mm-hmm. He's very well connected across the state, as Scott said, and he's got a lot of opportunities ahead of him for sure. I think we're all curious about what he'll do next.
And what is the chamber doing as far as finding his replacement?
So they're going to do a national search, and Brent Cooper, who's the president of an IT firm in downtown Covington, C-Forward, he's going to step in for the interim. I've talked to him, and they don't know exactly how long he's going to fill in, but he's already hard at work. They've put some committees together to explore. So he's not going to be a passive interim president. So the chamber is still going to function very aggressively. And Brent's a good guy. He did a great job as the steward of the chamber prior to Trey Grayson's arrival. And we'll wait and see what type of initiatives that they'll roll out under his leadership.
Now, we've had three code enforcement officers in Covington recently resign. You wrote about this in River City News. What is a code enforcement officer?
Code enforcement officers are the ones who get on you if your grass is too high, if you have some parts of your building that are
okay.
falling off. It's the type of gig that it's a very important, high-profile gig. It's very visible in the community because if you go to any type of government meetings, when citizens get up to speak, a lot of times there are criticism about this property next to me has it's falling apart or it's been burned out and it's not been repaired. And these are the guys who go out and enforce the code. So in Covington, I know every time we come on, we're talking about somebody who's departed City Hall. And to have three members of Covington's code enforcement resign within minutes of each other in the early morning hours via email, that was very surprising. Now, it may not be related to
But we don't know why they resigned. Nobody said
why. I obtained their emails and their explanations. They were relatively vague, but they talked a little bit about a hostile work environment. And what that means beyond that, I'm not entirely sure. But I know that the managers in that section of City Hall were quite surprised.
Now, we've had, as you were saying, Michael, we've had several staff departures. We've had since the new mayor and the new commission were elected, we've had the city manager, the finance director, the economic development director. What's the city doing to respond, to address these vacancies?
Well, Scott and I sat in the meeting on Tuesday at City Hall, they've narrowed down their national search for a new city manager to 8, they announced this week. So they're a little closer on that. So they have an interim city manager. They have an interim finance director. And the firm out of Phoenix that they've attached, Municipal Solutions, mm-hmm. I think they're called, they have been given an additional contract worth about $45,000 to evaluate the structure of City Hall, the organizational structure. So since you have all these open spots, the city's going to take the opportunity to evaluate what their needs are and how better to expend their resources.
It's kind of surreal right now in City Hall because they're assembling the budget and you have an interim finance director, an interim city manager, almost all the, other than the city attorney, Frank Warnock, almost all the veterans and familiar faces are gone.
And here's why that's important, because the form of government that the city of Covington has, the mayor commission, which is a state statute type of mm-hmm. government, the budget is prepared by the city manager with input from the commission and the finance director. So you have two interim people in the city manager and the finance director at this very critical stage because the budget has to be approved by the end of June. So they're the ones putting it together and they're not the permanent hires.
And the city's got a plan for things in the future, like the departure of the IRS building, which will the IRS is closing that down because everyone's filing online. So they're going to lose 1,800 employees, about $2 million in tax revenue. So there are a lot of things on the horizon that need to be addressed.
Yeah, there's a lot of things in the upswing in Covington. You see a lot of new construction, a lot of new small businesses that are opening, but that IRS thing looms large.
Now, Scott, some of the mystery that surrounded the Gateway Community and Technical College's vacant building, the one that sits up
yes.
on the hillside, some of that mystery is starting to go away now. We're starting to find some things out about what's going on with that building. What's going on there?
It's been a really odd process. I mean, even longtime elected leaders like former Judge Executive Ken Paul said they've never seen a bidding process like this. Gateway kept the bids and the whole selling of that property close to their vest. Exactly why, it wasn't quite clear. But the answer is it's an Ohio State rep that's buying the property. He's been involved with development here in the past, developed the views on the same hillside. But he plans on putting about 120, 200 homes up there, condos, single-family homes. If you have $400,000, $1 million, you can live in one of them.
Yeah, it's a big deal. This is a hillside with really gorgeous views. The project that Scott mentioned, the view sits just below it, and they have amazing views. So imagine being about 100 feet higher up, which is what these will be. It also impacts two cities. It affects Covington, and it impacts Park Hills, because the way you access that property, you have to go through Park Hills.
It's right on the border.
Yeah. So part of the property, like the old Park Hills Elementary School, which has been closed for a long time, it sits on that site as well. So Park Hills officials are paying close attention
to this. But there's been a lot of attention paid to it, because it's one of the last properties that has spectacular views of the Ohio Valley right in the urban area.
But the views, which sell for over $400,000, some over $600,000, are these gorgeous three-level townhomes. You can't even get in to see them. They're just flying off the market as fast as they get listed. So the market's really hot for this type of property, and I'll be anxious to see if that continues by the time they get this one off the ground.
Yeah, yeah. But it was just really interesting on how they kept it very secretive to the last minute. It's still not clear.
Yeah, and this wasn't like a Gateway specific thing necessarily, because Gateway is part of a state system, the Kentucky Community.
Right, and this particular building used to be what, their automotive.
Primarily, they had a classroom building, but mostly it was the automotive stuff, which they've moved out to Fort Wright in a new facility that looks really great out there. And so it wasn't like necessarily a Gateway decision. Downstate in Versailles, where the KCTCS is based, this was their decision to withhold this information. They treated it more like a private real estate transaction that will let you know when it's closed. When the deal is closed, we'll tell you who it is.
Which doesn't usually happen for public entities. Usually it's open, and so people can see how it's progressing.
So some of the mystery is solved, but not everything is solved yet.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, yeah. Just trickling out the information. So. And there's still questions on what why another developer actually bid more than the one that got it, but it's still not clear why.
Yeah, we hope to find that out soon.
Now, tell us about the management change that is going on. Newport on the Levee has a new GM.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Howard Dahl, who's been there. How long has he been there?
Harold Dahl has been there for 7 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And the guy who's replacing him, gosh, I don't have his name pulled up, but he's been there a long time. I think in the news release it said he's been there since 2001, which was right around the time that development opened. He's been the director of operations. So Harold's retiring, and the new guy's stepping in. And it's kind of a critical time, because there's all this new development that's popping up on the Newport Riverfront. And then you have the expansion of the Route 9 project that's impacting this as well. But last year, the levy contracted with a new firm in an effort to bring in more retail operations. Retail's long been a struggle at Newport on the Levee. So, like, the movie theater is very popular. The aquarium's obviously a big time destination. Barnes and Noble does okay in terms of attracting people, and the restaurants are hit and miss in terms of their success. And the retail has just been somewhat disastrous since it opened. Nothing has been sustainable. So it's a time for them to really reevaluate what they're going to do.
The thing about the Levee, I mean, the knock on the Levee, it never lived up to the expectations as far as stores, but. They do have a lot of longtime tenants that have stayed there for many years, Mitchell's Fish Market, yep. Barnes & Noble, the movie theater, and they should be getting a Ferris wheel in the next year or so. I mean, that looks like that's progressing, and it actually is going to be a real thing.
That's actually going to happen?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it. I was at a planning and zoning meeting in Newport last week, and I was there for another reason, but an issue related to zoning, the area where they would see this put, was on the agenda for discussion. So they are still at least evaluating.
I mean, big step, the Army Corps of Engineers has signed off on the new design, and that looks pretty promising.
And with the new apartments that have popped up around the Levee development and the hotels that are there, this is now more than just a retail and entertainment destination. It's kind of, it has the opportunity to be a neighborhood. So what will retail look like when there's a couple hundred new residents on both sides of it?
And how much are the traffic pattern changes they're making on Kentucky 9 going to play into the Levee's future?
Posted this at rcnky.com. Go check out the very specific details of these traffic patterns. But if you've driven around the Levee recently, you know that it's been a little messy. Route 9 expansion is a state project that aims to connect Licking Pike all the way to the Taylor Southgate Bridge. And with that, Newport's taken out a lot of properties, and there's going to be a couple of roundabouts put in at the foot of two bridges, one at the southern side of the Taylor Southgate Bridge and one on the eastern side of the Veterans Memorial or the 4th Street Bridge that connects Newport to Covington. So what they're moving forward now into the phase where those roundabouts will be constructed. So some of the ways that people were traveling over the past several months will now be reversed. So you've got to pay attention to the detours. They're mostly still one-way streets, and they're going to be detouring you all around that riverfront area of Newport.
513-419-7100 if you would like to join the conversation. Now, Michael, you also wrote about Park Hills Church that wants to put in a grotto. What's this about?
This is Our Lady of Lourdes. It's a new Catholic church that's in Park Hills. It is affiliated with the diocese, but it's a bit different. I think they do a Latin Mass, which is more of a classic form of practicing Catholicism, and they've renovated an old Lutheran church and turned it into this new Catholic church, Our Lady of Lourdes on Amsterdam Road. So at the last city council meeting, some neighbors showed up because of this proposed grotto that they want to put in. It's important to note what this church is named after. Our Lady of Lourdes references a 19th century experience where a woman claims to have seen an apparition of the Virgin Mary in Lourdes, France. And this church aims to replicate that grotto on a smaller scale, I suppose. They've got some renderings up on their website. If you Google Our Lady of Lourdes Park Hills, you can see some of the images. And some of the neighbors are concerned because some have claimed that it's half the size of the DeVue Park band shell, so it's a pretty large thing, mm-hmm. and that it could also be an attraction.
Right.
So people,
you get a lot of people making pilgrimages.
If the Virgin Mary's coming to Park Hills, Kentucky, you can bet some people are going to be taking that
reminiscent
exit
of what happened in, what was it, Cold Springs back in the early 90s.
I had to look this up because there was a comment about this on the story that I wrote, and it was 20 years ago that Cold Spring, St. Joseph's Church, there was a prediction that the Virgin Mary was going to make an appearance, and 8,000 people showed up for that. So I think the neighbors in Park Hills are concerned about that same thing happening.
If I remember correctly, she did not show.
Not everyone was allowed in the church to see, is what I read in an old New York Times article about it. But some people came out and gave vague references to feeling really good about the situation. But yeah, she didn't like to send from the sky and do anything.
Nothing wrong with good vibes.
It attracted a lot of people.
I remember witnessing
that. Mm-hmm. That was pretty amazing. So lots of people from all over the place. We will continue our conversation after this, and you're welcome to join us at 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with River City News editor and publisher Michael Monks, and also Scott Wortman, who does the River City News reporting for the Cincinnati Inquirer. So, gentlemen, thanks for sticking around for this next segment. Memorial services today for Jim Bunning.
Yes.
Former U.S. Senator and from Northern Kentucky, and also a major league pitcher. Died last Friday at the age of 85. So how's he being remembered?
He's being remembered very fondly in Northern Kentucky. My good friend Rick Robinson was a longtime staffer for then Congressman Bunning and wrote a very loving tribute for him. And I think you can read that in the Herald Leader today, too. So that piece is getting a lot of traction. Jim Bunning is a Hall of Fame pitcher. I mean, he threw two no-hitters in his career, a legendary athlete.
He also had a propensity for throwing pitches at beanballs, so to speak.
That's right.
He hit more batters than Nolan Ryan, who was also an angry guy and played for 10 more years than Jim Bunning, and he hit more batters than him.
That's right. Jim Bunning was sort of crotchety. You know, certainly in the time that I became a journalist, you know, he had gotten quite older, but he was in the Senate for two terms.
He prided himself on it. Even Rick Robinson agreed, like, he would throw pitches at you politically.
Exactly right.
And yeah.
That's exactly right. And so his visitation is today.
I got to go out there to his funeral home. We're not allowed, press aren't allowed in, so I just got to stand out on the sidewalk
outside.
Yeah.
And then there's, of course, the funeral mass is tomorrow at the Cathedral Basilica of the Assumption in Covington. What I think is important to recognize about Jim Bunning is that he did become a statewide political figure, but his career is really owed to how much he's loved in Northern Kentucky. I don't think Jim Bunning will rank high in terms of statewide political legends the way Wendell Ford, whom he replaced in the Senate, or Happy Chandler, or some of these more legendary political names. But in Northern Kentucky, Jim Bunning's a Hall of Famer again. And I think this is proved by some of his electoral history. And in 1983, he ran for governor, and it was nearly impossible for a Republican to be elected governor at that time. And he lost pretty big to Martha Lane Collins. He only won 30 out of 120 counties. But of course, course, he won the three major counties in northern Kentucky. When he was elected to Congress in 86, he would serve five terms. He got more than 56% of the vote every time, 74% of the vote twice, and more than 60% of the vote three times. And then when he ran for the United States Senate in 1988, he only beat Scotty Basler by half a percentage point. But Campbell, Kenton, and Boone really delivered for him. He won Campbell County 69-31% by 10,000 votes. He won Kenton County 70-30% by 16,000 votes. And he won Boone County 74-26 by 9,500 votes. And then in 04, when he was reelected, it was a similar story. It was the Northern Kentucky counties that put him over the top in a tight race.
And his relationship with Mitch McConnell was also strained. I mean, it was McConnell that pretty much pressured him not to seek reelection. And McConnell expresses condolences in a short statement, but one of the last times I spoke with Jim Bunning, and all conversations were brief with him, but I asked him, what's your relationship with McConnell? Like, passive, just like everyone else in the Senate.
But it kind of ties back a little bit to Trey Grayson, that point, because in 2010, when Jim Bunning ultimately decided not to seek a third term in the United States Senate, and I think it's pretty well reported that he had wanted to, Mitch McConnell urged him not to, and he put his support behind whom we talked about earlier, Trey Grayson, who was Secretary of State at the time. And Trey Grayson did seek the Republican nomination that year, but he lost in that Tea Party wave to Rand Paul. So, and what's interesting to note is that this Northern Kentucky love for Jim Bunning did not translate to Trey Grayson, who's also a Northern Kentucky native. Rand Paul, who's from Bowling Green, won Kenton, Boone, and Campbell counties overwhelmingly.
And Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton joins us now. Hi, Ryland.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thank you. What are your thoughts on the passing of Jim Bunning?
It was really interesting talking to Republicans after his passing. Spoke very fondly of him and really credited him with building up the Republican Party in Northern Kentucky and thereby kind of building up the Republican Party in Kentucky as a whole. As you mentioned, Rand Paul winning that Senate seat in 2010, that really kind of, switching that area over to a solidly, in many places, a solidly Republican region of the state really helped pave the way to kind of the Republican wave that we've seen across the state, in these statewide races over the last couple election cycles.
And Scott had to exit because, as he said, he has to go cover the memorial service for Jim Bunning. Ryland, you wrote about Kentucky Attorney General Andy Beshear, so we're going to move on to something else here. He's calling for an investigation of a home purchase by Governor Matt Bevin. Can you fill us in on what's going on with that?
Sure. This is an ongoing, unfolding story, first reported by the Courier-Journal about a month ago. Governor Matt Bevin apparently bought a mansion outside of Louisville in Anchorage, and at least according to if you compare how much he bought it for, which is about $1.7 million, to how much it was listed for according to the county estimates, which is about $2.7 million, it seems like he got about $1 million discount on it. Also appears that the previous owner of the house was a fellow named Neil Ramsey, who is an investment executive, and the governor appointed him to the Kentucky Retirement Systems Board. That's one of the boards that oversees state pensions. And he also is a political donor to the governor. So there's some questions as to whether the governor got a deal on this house in exchange or somehow in relationship to his appointment and relationship to this political appointee. Go ahead.
Who would investigate? I mean, is such an investigation likely to happen?
It's something that the executive branch ethics commission could investigate. They don't talk about what investigations they have ongoing, or they don't talk about whether they're going to investigate somebody. And so the attorney general's asked them if he should be the one to investigate. He, at least as of earlier this week, said he hadn't heard back yet. So it's something that it doesn't, besides right now the news media looking into it, that it doesn't, it's unclear if there's any kind of official investigation going into it.
And it's given the governor the opportunity to lash out at the media. He had a Facebook video that he posted that was about 10 minutes long. It's gotten over a million views. A lot of his fans are excited about the way he dressed down the media in the same fashion that Donald Trump might do. He's basically called this a non-story and has used this opportunity to say, I will speak directly to the people of Kentucky through my social media platforms, and I don't need to filter myself through these allegedly agenda-driven reporters at the major papers in the state.
Ryland, Bevin, meantime, is touting that companies have promised to invest $5.8 billion in Kentucky. So who are some of these companies he's talking about?
Toyota, there are three big investments that have happened so far this year. There's Toyota, which is planned, I think it was a $1.3 billion investment in its Georgetown plant. Also, Brady Industries, an aluminum, or a company that's starting up an aluminum rolling factory in eastern Kentucky in Greenup County along the Ohio River out there. And then there is there's one other $1 billion investment. It's escaping right now that the governor is credited to the state's new right to work law, which has gone into effect this year. He's credited these promised investments. They haven't been, these haven't been totally fulfilled yet. But it's the same deal. This is kind of how it works. Companies say that they're going to invest a certain amount of money, a certain number of jobs will come. I think the jobs going along with this, it's about 9,500 jobs. That are supposed to come along with these investments.
You mentioned right to work. There are several lawsuits over that, aren't there?
Yeah, there's a couple of unions that both the Teamsters in Louisville as well as the AFL-CIO of Kentucky have sued the governor along with the Secretary of the Labor Cabinet, Derek Ramsey, over the new right to work law. And basically, they're just trying to stop it in its tracks. They say that they shouldn't be required to provide union benefits to people who don't pay union dues. So, the right to work law forbids companies from requiring workers to pay union dues, even if they're a unionized company. And so, unions are objecting to that, and they say that it's unconstitutional under the state constitution.
Well, and where do those stand right now? Have those just been filed, or where are they at in the legal system?
They've just been filed, so it's if there's motions to stop it immediately, that's something we might have hearings over in the next month or so. But this was just filed, I think, 2 weeks ago now.
Michael, we have to wrap things up with solving the mystery of Covfefe, Covfefe.
Covfefe, baby, finally. Let's talk about it. Yeah, of course, Donald
Trump. Because we've only got about 45 seconds left to get this vital point
Well, thank
point
you for
in.
The time. Donald Trump's
late-night tweet. What's this doing to Covington? It's causing a bit of a stir.
You know, one thing that you just got to love about Covington, in spite of its struggles and on top of its impressive renaissance, is that the city and most of its citizens have quite a sense of humor about itself, and Covfefe gave us the opportunity to celebrate that. I had a little fun with it on the RCN
like
Facebook
page.
It kind of does, yeah. It's kind of, I've been asked, I would like to be called Covfefe myself, but there was a petition started that got in front of me. So someone has asked that you sign the petition and let's officially change the name of the city of Covington to the city of Covfefe.
No, I don't think so.
It's blowing up on Facebook,
I
can tell you that.
I don't think so. Ryland and Michael, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks.
Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Ryland Barton, River City News Editor and Publisher Michael Monks, and we were also joined by Inquirer River City's reporter Scott Wortman.